Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views and the views of our guest. And our guest this evening is Colonel Ron Ray. And, Colonel Ray was a retired Marine Corps colonel, fought in Vietnam. He certainly served under the Reagan administration as Assistant Secretary of Defense. He's been on the front lines of the battle to try to preserve the Christian heritage of this country, has prepared a number of briefs that have been presented to the highest courts of our country. And without further ado, we're going to talk about the attack on Christianity in America today. And I don't think you can understand much of what's going on unless you understand, as it tells us in the Holy Scriptures, that there is an organized conspiracy against God. And whether it be certainly in Ezekiel 22:25 or the second Psalm, there have always been those who would destroy the Word of God. And they are working very hard in America today. And this is why they took God and prayer and the Ten Commandments out of our institutions, and why they're trying to take prayer out of our service academy. So with that as the background, Colonel Ray, please pick up the story.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. This is very timely, and it's a developing story. Yesterday, the Associated Press did a little summation, focusing first on the Naval Academy. The Naval Academy's been threatened over the last 3 years by the American Civil Liberties Union, and then most recently by B'nai B'rith, the Jewish Freemasonry of the Anti-Defamation League. And they have refused to give up a traditional prayer going back to the founding of the Academy in 1845, that they have a formal prayer offered at the lunch meal in which all the midshipmen are present. But in the Associated Press release, they pointed out that the Air Force has this a new policy that the to discourage most public prayer. And that's been in the press in the last couple of days. Again, there have been a lot of pressures brought in. Some of the same groups have been very critical of the Air Force Academy, so they've dropped prayer. The Naval Academy's refused to drop prayer. The article mentioned that the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, no prayer precedes the noon meal there. The Air Force Academy is going to have 20 seconds of silence before lunch, period. The Citadel dropped its prayer under pressure from the ACLU a year and a half ago, and Virginia Military Institute, which was the centerpiece of litigation brought by the ACLU and also attacked by the American Jewish Committee, the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, and a group called Citizens United for Separation of Church and State, have put a lot of pressure on them. But despite the media coverage, the VMI came out of that case with the right to restore its mealtime prayer, and its board of visitors are currently considering whether to do that. So what we're seeing in time of war, we're seeing these radical groups that have been attacking various elements of Christianity in our society essentially since they were, most of these groups came into public knowledge right after World War One. The brief that was filed in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals by the ACLU and these other groups really had extreme language. They called historic military mealtime prayers. Now, these are leader-led, sometimes chaplain-led, non-sectarian prayers, very common throughout our military services and academies, going all the way back to 1774. We, in our research, tracked uncovered 67 prayer books that were distributed to our fighting forces, including the Midshipman's Prayer, the Cadet Prayer at West Point, which was Eisenhower's favorite prayer throughout his life, as well as Omar Bradley, the first chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And so they claim this was religious indoctrination. That's what in their brief. They said that these mealtime prayers constituted religious indoctrination and represented religious fanaticism.
Hold that thought right there, please. Well, I guess this evening, Colonel Ron Ray, and we're talking about the briefs that have been filed by the, what I refer to as the Anti-Christian Lawyers Union, the ACLU, because that is really its purpose. It's to undermine and destroy the Christian fabric of this society, the great Christian foundation of this society, and they object to prayer of any sort. Now, they don't object when, say, the president called people to prayer after 9/11. But their attacks will be on the minds of the young people of this country and destroy the religious foundation of our military. You destroy our military. They know exactly what they're doing, and they're part of an anti-Christian movement in this country, and it permeates every aspect of our society. So pick up the story there.
Yeah, I was going to say, they use. You talk about hate crimes, you talk about extremism. The language used in a brief filed in the Fourth Circuit in the VMI case by this group of radical groups, they called these non-sectarian, and they, believe me, these are very watered down prayers for family, for VMI, for country, for the Corps of Cadets. In other words, these are very watered down prayers. They're not in the name of Jesus Christ. They're like I said, non-sectarian prayers, and they call that religious indoctrination. And they said these prayers represent, this is a quote from the brief, religious fanaticism and ideological proselytizing that are engendering animosity and destruction worldwide.
And but talk about religious bigotry. I mean, they are the epitome of bigotry, and yet and they're anti-Christian bigots, but nobody's going to say that. Oh my goodness, you know, that these people are just trying to enforce the wall of separation of church and state. No, they have an intense hatred of America, and they know this was founded as a Christian nation, that they can destroy the Christian foundation of our this nation. They can destroy this nation. That's what it's really about.
And to do it at the time of war, they've got people intimidated. They've got it set up now. The way these cases go down, if the ACLU wins any part of its claim, and these groups win any part of the claim, they can, even against the public body, they can go back and get their attorney's fees, you know, which is basically using the public treasury as a way to de-Christianize America. But I want you to know I'm making a sharp distinction between their efforts in the military, which are relatively recent, as opposed to the 65 years that they've dedicated themselves. Again, going all the way back, the first public trial the ACLU was in was the Scopes trial in 1925 in Dayton, Tennessee, when they took on the notion of the crime of Tennessee of teaching evolution, which was against the law. In fact, Scopes was found guilty.
Hold that thought right there for just a moment. Well, Dr. Stan and our guest this evening, Colonel Ron Ray, just tracking the history of the ACLU, the Athletic Communist Anti-Christian Lawyers Association, the ACLU, or union, the Anti-Christian Lawyers Union, and how they'd really begun their attack on Christianity with the Scopes trial. And, of course, they wanted to get teaching or mention of God out of our schools. First of all, they wanted to bring evolution into our schools and not allow anybody to mention that it was God that created the heaven and the earth, and that was actually our foundation of our freedom was based upon God, the words of our Declaration of Independence, that talked about our Creator that gave us life, liberty, and property, and that to secure these liberties, why governments were created among men, deriving their power from the consent of the governed. They've got to do away with this idea of the Creator if they're going to do away with the idea of freedom under God and replace it with subservience under the government that they will support.
Well, that's true, and it is interesting that the Declaration of Independence, lawyers are not taught this anymore, but the Declaration of Independence, if you go into American law, if you look at the public statutes at large of the United States of America, which was widely printed in the early 1840s. Remember, the founders were starting to die, then when the founders, finally the last one, I think, was James Madison that died, for the first 60 years of this country, if somebody had a thought about what the founders really intended, all they had to do was talk to them. But they began to die away, and there was a capturing of the formation of the Union. There was a book published by the United States Senate with the approval of the House of Representatives that funded it. And it was called The Formation of the Union, and they published the statutes at large. And the first statute of American law is the Declaration of Independence. The second one is the Articles of Confederation. The third is the Constitution. The fourth is the Northwest Ordinance. The fifth is the Bill of Rights. In other words, these are the organic laws that found America, and it basically says that there's a self-evident truth, that there's a Creator. And these men are speaking as statesmen, not as churchmen. The sad thing to me, Stan, is I've worked in these cases now for many, many years, going back 15 or 16 years, virtually full-time. The two groups of Americans who know the least about the why America is a Christian nation or what it means to be one nation under God or would understand why we have a national motto of In God We Trust are pastors, Christian pastors from across America, and lawyers. They've both been indoctrinated. They both have a very poor understanding of the foundations of American law and civil government, and the pastors don't know how to talk about it in a way that would be historically based under the history of the state. They talk church talk. They sound like Jerry Falwell. They sound like Pat Robertson in the public arena, which is not exactly how these things should be talked about. But it is important to know that the ACLU was founded and funded to be a legal arm as part of a well-organized effort against America, a Christian nation. Most lawyers have never heard that the Supreme Court, between 1844 and 1931, held four times that America was a Christian nation. And what did they mean by that? And what did the court say in 1892, February 29th, the famous case, Holy Trinity Church versus United States? The court deliberated 10 years. I'm going to say that again. It wasn't just during a single term. They deliberated and researched for 10 years before they issued an opinion in that case and studied the history of America's founding going all the way back to 1492. The first document they reviewed was the charter to Christopher Columbus from the King and Queen of Spain. So from the discovery in 1492 to 1892 when this opinion was handed down was a period of 400 years and the unanimous court said that all of our organic utterances, now that's a term that most Americans don't understand anymore, but 50 or 60 or 80 years ago they would understand that that's the structure of your government. That's not just a statute that Congress passes. It's not just a court case. This is the organic laws that make up the structure of our limited and separated powers that make us a constitutional republic. And they said for 400 years, from 1492 to 1892, there was not a single organic utterance to the contrary, that we were religious people, that our laws and institutions were based on principles from the Old and New Testament, and to this extent, from the discovery of the continent to this present hour, there's a single voice making this affirmation, this is a Christian nation. And that was echoed, as I say, from 1844 as recently as 1931. And with the election of Franklin Roosevelt and in his administration, Felix Frankfurter of Harvard Law School, who was one of the founders of the ACLU, very active with Roscoe Pound, the 33rd degree Mason at Harvard. Frankfurter was early in the U.S. War Department, used Harold Lasky to help mastermind the conference in England with the Fabian Socialists. Lasky was the chief liaison officer between the Fabian Socialists of England and their counterparts in the United States. And Frankfurter used his influence to bring Lasky to Harvard to lecture for 4 years in a period 1916 to 1920. This was the formative period. Frankfurter probably brought more young lawyers into the New Deal in the Roosevelt administration, and then eventually he's put on the court in 1939. And in 1940 and 41, that begins the 65-year period when there were a whole series of cases in the U.S. Supreme Court, during which high-degree Masons controlled the court from 41 to 71, you begin to get the series of so-called separation of church and state cases, usually brought by the ACLU or similar groups, and you had Frankfurter on the court appearing to be a conservative, coordinating these efforts behind the scenes, meeting with ACLU groups while he was a sitting Supreme Court justice. And it's very interesting. I found something that you may not be familiar with. I found a page of the Congressional Record that was published in 1930, and records a letter that Theodore Roosevelt wrote to Frankfurter in December the 19th, 1917. And this is what it said. Former President Teddy Roosevelt, writing directly to Frankfurter, "You have taken," said President Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, "an attitude which seems to me to be fundamentally that of Trotsky and the other Bolshevik leaders in Russia, an attitude which may be fraught with mischief to this country." Well, that's an understatement, and we're experiencing it today. Now, let me bring you forward to say that in they're lawless. This is a legal revolutionaries, because the ACLU has lost a series of cases against civilian colleges where they've attacked prayer at various ceremonies in civilian colleges. And in each of the cases, the ACLU loses, and the courts have uniformly said, and these are appeals courts in this country, have said, there's nothing wrong with adults, that is 18 years old and older, adults being called together in a formal prayer at a civilian college. And of course, the military has a much different standard, so the notion that they would attack the military when they've lost the cases in civilian colleges would let you know that they don't abide by the law. They don't abide by a series of determinations in court after full and complete hearings. They continually press their radical agenda. Even though they did not prevail in the VMI, they prevailed like they did. Just like in 1925, when Scopes was convicted, the media made a monkey out of the people of Tennessee who believed that creation was the proper account, who agreed with the founding fathers that it was a self-evident truth. And even though they lost the case, just like the ACLU lost the case in VMI, the media presented it the other way, including the Christian press, the consult, and intimidating, because we have a lot of weak-kneed people. A lot of the flag and general officers at senior levels now were promoted to their present ranks during the Clinton administration, and they were very selective in looking for politically correct and folks that would accommodate some of these radical agendas.
Well, I think, Colonel, it's so important, and I really want you to explain to our listeners why prayer is so important as far as our military is concerned, because certainly this has been, even if you don't believe, in the God of heaven and that and the sovereignty of God, there have been scientific studies that show it is the prayer that has created the cohesiveness in our military and the effectiveness of our military, and there's no question that if you undermine the religious faith of our men, you will destroy the effectiveness of our fighting services. So what was that study that was done following the Second World War?
Well, it's really the most massive social science research ever undertaken. And it was done really before the close of the war. They had researchers on the ground, and they were trying to and these were sociologists. These were not necessarily conservative people. These were very progressive people who would have studied sociology, the founders of which, one of the founders of sociology was Karl Marx. And these were folks that that were trying to find out why men fight. And it was an interesting investigation that they conducted, and they determined at the end of the day that the title of the study when it was published was The American Soldier, Combat and Its Aftermath. It was published by the Princeton University Press in 1949, reporting on data about the importance of prayer to officers and enlisted infantrymen in all our theaters in the Mediterranean, North Africa, European theater, and, of course, the Far East, China-Burma theater, as well as in the Pacific. And they found out, after questioning these men, that it wasn't their... They weren't fighting for the guy on the right and guy on the left. We hear so much about that in the Vietnam War, and we hear about that in the war in Iraq. You know, the prayer helped a great deal. Prayer was the main thing that sustained them in combat. And I guess what I'm saying is the study proves what most Christians would believe, that we have a God answering. The Creator answers prayers, and American military men have led their soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines in prayer before they lead them in battle, or right down through until the Vietnam War.
And, of course, the Anti-Christian Lawyers Union and the other organizations would destroy our military. They know what they're doing. And where is the outcry from our Christian leaders? Where is the outcry from our ministers? And, well, you're going to have to understand what this is about. There is a conspiracy against God. And once you understand that, so much of what's taking place in our country today begins to make sense. We'll be back here in just a moment with our special guest this evening, Colonel Ron Ray. Well, Colonel, why don't you pick the story up there?
Well, I will. I mean, if you look at the prayer books that we pulled together to talk about its importance going all the way back to 1774... These are prayers, not these non-sectarian, watered-down prayers, but these are strong, really powerful prayers. And we're talking about presidents, we're talking about our greatest statesmen, we're talking about secretaries of the Army, secretaries of the Navy, secretaries of War, we're talking about our leading admirals and generals, that these prayers were collected. And by private groups as well as the government, and government funds were expended to distribute them to our fighting forces in every war, from the Revolutionary War right down to the present time.
Now, you've actually compiled all these in the report, haven't you?
Yes, we have. We put them together, and actually it was published as an appendix in our brief in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, but the appendix itself is entitled Senior American Commander's Professional Military Judgment Concerning Crucial Importance of Official Prayer to the American Military's Morale and Well-Being. It was published by the Naval Aviation Foundation, Admiral Thomas H. Moore, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and some of his colleagues, as well as the Coalition of American Veterans. And it's just really powerful. If you'd like to see that whole brief and to see that report that contains selected prayers down through the history of the United States, as well as the history of prayer in the United States Armed Forces, you can look at firstprinciplespress.org. There's a website. There's a lot of material on the attack on prayer in the military, a lot of material in there about the VMI case. And there's a wonderful background. We pulled together excerpts from every inaugural address of every president going back to George Washington. And in every president of the United States recognized the existence of the Creator of the Declaration of Independence, recognized the divine providence or the government of God and the blessing of God as essential to the creation of America and its preservation. And every president, including Bill Clinton twice, used prayer and petition to ask for the continuation of God's blessing and his divine providence in preserving America through their administration. And so the president calls us to pray when there's a crisis, as they did after 9/11 as commander-in-chief. And here we have young men and women at West Point who are left without a prayer. At least the mealtime prayer. The Citadel has abandoned prayer. The Air Force Academy has recently run down its colors when the president is calling to pray. And you'll say, who's more influential, who's more powerful in this country, the President of the United States or these radical and revolutionary groups. And there is no call from the churches. There's no call in Congress. There was a bill in the last Congress in 2004. It was a bill introduced, I think it was H.R. 4200, the National Defense Authorization Act, and it did have a provision in Section 556 to provide for each academy superintendent to have authority with respect to the offering of a voluntary non-denominational prayer at the academies. They had the authority to do it, and I'm not so sure that that actually stayed in the bill. I'm not so sure that that passed. I think it was taken out during the conference committee, but it was promoted by a Republican congressman from North Carolina who has been interested. But you don't see the leadership of the Republican Party. You don't see the leadership of our broad-based pro-family and conservative organizations paying any attention. Well, this is front-page news in the United States today, and we're at war. And in Vietnam, Stan, it was an interesting thing. You didn't see a lot of leader-led prayer in Vietnam, but one of the you'd hear different men talk about terrible situations, like the Marines up at Khe Sanh, when they were describing it as being desperate. They said, well, those guys don't have a prayer. That ship in harm's way doesn't have a prayer.
Hold that thought right there, Colonel. We'll be right back here. Well, our guest this evening is Colonel Ron Ray, and we're simply talking about the organized, coordinated effort to get prayer out of our military academies, and where are the Republican leaders who pretend to be such good, staunch Christians, and why, of course, they're not saying anything at all. They're going right along with the ACLU and these other organizations. They could take a position of leadership. The Republicans control the House of Representatives. They control the Senate. They control the administration, the executive branch of government. And they could pass legislation very, very easily and put a rider on it saying that the Supreme Court or any other federal court can change this at all. This is allowed by Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution. It would be a very simple thing to end all of this foolishness. But you see, they talk, they posture, but they don't do anything. And that's really the problem we have today. Okay. If you read the Constitution of every state, all 50 of our states, every one of them, somewhere in the opening paragraphs talks about God. Every one of our state constitutions. And as our Declaration of Independence talked about God. As our Constitution was signed in this day of our Lord. Oh, what Lord were they talking about? They were talking about Jesus Christ. For our listeners out there, go down to your local law library and get a copy of the case of the Church of the Holy Trinity versus United States. That's the Church of the Holy Trinity versus United States, and get the law, the people in the law library, to run it off for you and read it through. And understand this was 1891, 1992, that the Supreme Court held that America was a Christian nation. You will never find that taught in law school. You'll never find that taught in the seminaries. You'll never find that taught in our universities across America, because there truly is a conspiracy against God. Colonel, go ahead.
Well, I wanted to say that your point's well taken. It was only recently that I understood that the court actually deliberated and researched the 10 years before they finally issued that opinion. They found 66 authorities that they cited, and they said these and a mass of other organic utterances all speak with a single voice for 400 years, from 1492 to 1892, that America is a Christian nation. What's very interesting is if you look at the case of Engle versus Vitale, the 1962 case, 6-3, when the Supreme Court struck down the 350-year-old practice of prayer in our common or public school systems across America, they did it by citing not a single case. There was no precedent to cite. And in 1963, the next year, when they took Bible reading, they struck down Bible reading as a violation of the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. They cited one authority, the Engle versus Vitale case of the previous year. And what we have is we have created a dictatorship of a minority in terms of, they call it judicial activism, but that's not enough. Books have been written talking about government by judiciary by a great liberal Democrat named Raoul Berger, who was the chief legal historian, not a lawyer, at Harvard Law School. Wrote a great book called Government by Judiciary, The History of the Transformation of the 14th Amendment. And there was a book by a fellow named Kilgore called Judicial Tyranny. But let's look at what the Founding Fathers, you know, they love to quote Thomas Jefferson's letter of 1802, January the 1st, to the Danbury Baptist, where he used the phrase separation of church and state. They quote that, but they don't want to look at his later writings when the notion of the Supreme Court is perhaps exercising unwarranted authority. This is what he wrote to a very close friend in 1820. This is Washington's own, Thomas Jefferson's own words. To consider the Supreme Court judges the ultimate arbiters of all constitutional questions is a very dangerous doctrine indeed, and one which would place us under the despotism of an oligarchy. They have, with others, the same passions for party, for power and privilege. Their power is the more dangerous as they are in office for life and not responsible, as the other functionaries are, to the elective control. The Constitution has erected no such single tribunal. Close quote. That's what we don't know. And they've gained ground, these radical groups, primarily through intimidation. They've exercised an extraordinary non-elected power. Very few people will speak out against them. And they frequently, like they did at the Citadel, like they've done at West Point, and there's been no lawsuit filed at the Air Force Academy, but they do have a lot of friends in the media, and they write threatening and intimidating letters. They threaten to drag you through a long and expensive litigation with adverse publicity, and people will simply cave in to their demands.
Well, this is time then that we're going to certainly ask you to hang on. We'll be back here in just a moment. Our enemy is certainly not over in Iran or in Iraq or hiding in a cave in Pakistan. The enemy of America that will destroy this nation is working right here. Domestic enemies who have a different agenda, working in Washington, D.C. to destroy what was once the land of the free and the home of the brave. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly our military academies are under attack today. And, of course, the great difficulty is that some of the Air Force officers, high-ranking officers, generals, are going right along with this. In fact, it's my understanding that one of the senior cadets at the Air Force Academy, as was the custom to send out emails and advise the lower cadets about what they thought was important, and one of those senior cadets suggested that to the lower cadets at the Air Force Academy that they consider prayer and they consider the relationship with our Lord. And he was called in and actually, of course, chastised for daring to do something terrible and subversive like saying we ought to worship our Lord.
Well, he really didn't go quite that far, although that's a fair interpretation. I believe he identified himself as a Christian, but he said, you have to remember in his email, and this is when the about to graduate seniors are writing some things that they think would be wisdom and lessons learned to the younger men and women in the classes that are not going to be graduating. These are things to the wisdom from our experience, and he said that you remember you serve God first, then your country, then your family. And he said, be sure to remember every year to participate in the National Day of Prayer. Well, the President of the United States calls the National Day of Prayer and calls people to pray. And he was called in and specifically targeted to say and told that what he'd said in that email was inappropriate at the Air Force Academy. And the point is that this is a complete overturning of the history of this country from 1774 down to the present time. The notion that there was anything wrong with prayer at the service academies or prayer in the armed forces has never been suggested. And here it is. I thought when these suits were brought prior to 9/11 in 2001, that when the attack in the World Trade Center occurred and the attack on the Pentagon occurred, that these suits would be non-suited or they would not be pursued, because no enemy would be so bold in time of war, when we've actually been attacked here in the homeland, the greatest national security failure in the history of this country, that nobody would pursue prayer when the President of the United States is calling the whole nation to prayer. But lo and behold, these groups press forward and with the most radical and extreme kind of language. And I've gone back and looked at the history of these a lot of these groups, and it's interesting to see the names, the connections to the communist movement and various front groups, the American Friends for the Spanish Democracy, the American Committee for Anti-Nazi Literature. A fellow named John Dewey was involved with a fellow named Morris Cohen to found a forerunner to the ACLU in the Conference on Legal and Social Philosophy. And you see that they were bragging in their early
writings.
Hold
that thought for just a moment when we bring our stations on board. Okay. All right, fine. And first, Colonel Ray was just saying that that John Dewey and another gentleman would actually... were created the organizations. It was the forerunner to the ACLU, and they were bragging. Go right ahead with that.
Yeah, Morris Cohen's wrote when he was at Harvard. This is what he wrote. Socialists can learn from their adversaries that it is always possible to attack existing law, and if the power is available, to destroy existing law, even in the name of democracy, justice, and liberty. In the name of the great ideals of the American Constitution, or in the name of the law itself. And you can find that that's quoted in November 1935, Socialism and the Myth of Legality, and in the American Socialist Quarterly, and it's also quoted in an interesting book called The Great Deception.
All right, well, I just wanted to read something that Thomas Jefferson had written, because I think this is so important. And this comes from his book, The Master Thoughts of Thomas Jefferson, which is a summary of his great letters. It has long been my opinion, and I have never shrunk from its expression, that the germ of dissolution of our federal government is in the constitution of our federal judiciary, an irresponsible body, for impeachment is scarcely a scarecrow, working like gravity by night and by day, gaining a little today and a little tomorrow, and advancing its noiseless step like a thief over the field of jurisdiction until all shall be usurped from the states and the government of all be consolidated into one. To this I am opposed, because when all government, domestic and foreign, in little as in great things, shall be drawn to Washington as the center of all power, it will render powerless the checks of one government on another, and will become as venal and oppressive as the government from which we separated. And I think those words should echo to us down through the decades and over the centuries, because Thomas Jefferson foresaw exactly what is taking place in America today.
Well, you can do something about this in a way. I mean, you certainly should alert the fact that the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith has said they're going to take their case against the Naval Academy to Congress this fall. Well, Congress has come back early because of the disaster in the Gulf Coast and New Orleans particularly, and there was a vote to provide some emergency funding for that. And so you can certainly contact and write your congressman and both of your senators to say to oppose the groups and any effort to attack prayer at the service academies, particularly any pressures that are brought together against the Naval Academy. And you might, if you know folks connected to the Naval Academy, you might encourage them to make the stand. You'd write the superintendent of the Naval Academy and tell him to continue to defend the practice of prayer at the Naval Academy. I went back through the House Un-American Activities reports, and there was a special committee to investigate communist activities in America that issued a report in January of 1931. This is what they said in their looking at the American Civil Liberties Union. They said it was closely affiliated with the communist movement in the United States, and that fully 90% of its efforts are on behalf of communists who have come into conflict with local laws and law enforcement. It claims to stand for free speech, free press, and free assembly, but it's quite apparent that the main function of the ACLU is to attempt to protect the communists in their advocacy of force and violence to undermine or overthrow the government, replacing the American flag by a red flag and erecting a Soviet government in place of the Republican form of government guaranteed to each state by the federal constitution. They went on to say in later reports that the ACLU lined up squarely with a defined socialist agenda: atheism, sexual freedom, disarmament, seditious academic freedom, fighting deportation of those convicted of treason, rioting, or strikes. You know, this group's foundation is not something that is red, white, and blue. And the notion that they say their client is the Bill of Rights, and they get a lot of politicians on both sides that seem to be willing to give them credibility today, that their history and their current, by their fruit you shall know them, their current fruit is not worthy of that kind of support.
And of course, the problem is that the ACLU, the Anti-Christian Lawyers Union, always has the support of the major media. It also has support of the people within the Council on Foreign Relations who are going exactly the same direction, because the purpose of the Council on Foreign Relations is really to create a one-world government, but a new world religion. This is not coming from a Christian point of view, and if you see where the power of the ACLU and these other groups come from, it has never been their own power. It has been the power of the people who control the media, the power of the people who control the great tax-exempt foundations, and the power of the people who have appointed people to the Supreme Court to undermine the very fabric of our society.
You know what? It's what the real problem is, though, as big as these enemies are and as well-funded as they are, the Bible makes clear the judgment begins at the house of God, and the good Lord only gives success to the enemies of God when his people are out of line. I read a very important book some years ago and was stunned to find a quote in Douglas Southall Freeman's great trilogy, Lee's Lieutenants. Now, Freeman is perhaps one of the great American biographers of the 20th century. He wrote a 7-volume history of George Washington that's wonderful, a 4-volume history of the life of Robert E. Lee. But then he wrote a kind of a culminating of his work in the War Between the States in terms of a 3-volume set on Lee's Lieutenants. And then the introduction. He points out that he, in the course of his research over decades, he had read 30 or 40,000 letters of all ranks on both sides in the War Between the States, and what you can say is, he said the acceptance of traditional Christianity was almost universal. These men, in a page of these letters, kept religion in the same sanctuary of the heart with patriotism and love of their homes. Mild and reverent deism was viewed with horror. Doubt was damnation. Agnosticism was service to Antichrist. What was believed was professed. And he talked about the examples of when a man was wounded on a Civil War battlefield, the first question put to him was whether he was right with God. And what he goes on to say is these letters are just powerful testimonies. And he says, in the period of time from 1865 to 1940, and this book came out in the early 1940s, he said there was a greater loss of faith in America in those 60-some years than at any other time in recorded history. In other words, he's contrasting the period of the War Between the States, 1861 to 1865, to the period of the beginning of World War II. And he's saying that in that period of time, there was a complete transformation of the degree of faith exhibited in the life of Americans. And we think it happened after World War II. We think it happened sometime in the 60s. Freeman's making the point that it happened much sooner than that. And so we're seeing, we were running in the late 40s and 50s through up to the sexual revolution and the civil rights activity and all the revolutionary activity that broke out during the Vietnam War. We were running on the fumes of an earlier era where there was profound faith, and America could truly have been called in those days a Christian nation.
I think it's important that our people out there listening to us across America understand what's going on. And of course, while our attention is focused on what's taking place in Iraq and certainly what's taking place in New Orleans, why those people who would destroy our country are going to continue their effort to destroy prayer, the Christian foundation of the beliefs of the people, certainly at the military academies, and the fact that any of them would give in simply reflects the fact that we have within the hierarchy of our military people who have turned their back on God, from whom all freedom comes. I would suspect that the Navy would probably hold out better than the Army. I've always been impressed that the leadership of the Navy really is sort of the bulwark of our armed forces. Of course, that's where the Marines come from, too, isn't it, Colonel?
Well, there was a time when the War Department was had the Army, and then, of course, the Army Air Corps was all one service, and the Navy included the Marine Corps, and there's no question the independence, the expeditionary nature of the Navy and Marine Corps. They used to talk about the going down to the sea in the ship, and one of the sailors' prayer was, "Oh Lord, thy sea is so vast, and my ship is so small," you know, and that was the beginning of a prayer. So I think that a man who spends his life on the unstable sea is different than a man who would spend his life on land, and I think. take their attitude, the one man can seem much more secure than he does on the ocean. And I think the devotion, the nature of devotion in those that go down to the sea in ships is a phrase from the Bible. There's a Eternal Father Strong to Save is the anthem of the Naval Academy. And during the attack several years ago, while VMI was being attacked and the ACLU wrote a threatening letter to the Naval Academy leadership, VMI played at the Naval Academy in a football game. And it was really one of those really great moments that should have been recorded if the media was had any any sense of patriotism at all, because they had a prayer that was offered before the ball game, which was not extraordinary. And then the whole Corps of Midshipmen stood up and sang, which never happened at a Navy football game. And here was VMI coming in, Eternal Father Strong to Save, which is essentially a prayer. They sang standing in defiance of the ACLU and their threat to take away prayer. They sang their anthem, which is a prayer, right there to the with the visiting VMI football team on the field. And I got a call from some of the members of the Naval Aviation Foundation who I'd represented in that matter, who were at the game to report exactly what occurred. And these retired admirals were just delighted with the fact that the Corps, with all the politically correct forces that are at work in our academies, here was an unbroken declaration of fortitude and courage and defiance and dedication, and which would reflect on why In God We Trust could still be and should still be America's motto. Even people like George Marshall, you know, and we know about his role in China and what have you, but George Marshall repeatedly said that he looked upon the spiritual life of the soldier as even more important than his physical equipment. And he said that and elaborated on that very often. And the prayers that he recommended be distributed to the fighting forces in Korea, I was impressed. They were very strong. And he's a graduate of VMI, was the first cadet at VMI, top of his class at VMI, and they've got his statue down there as well as Stonewall Jackson. But even George Marshall said prayer was essential, and the spiritual life of the soldier is more important than his technology or his equipment.
Well, Colonel, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get in touch with your website, how they can get the material that you have, because especially that the booklet that you used as you compiled when you were presenting the brief to the court, you know, that lists all of the prayers, these great and wonderful prayers from the old prayer books and from our military leaders. How can they get hold of that information?
You can go on the web at First Principles Press, and then it's Principles, L-E-S, not A-L. It's Principles, L-E-S, firstprinciplespress.org, firstprinciplespress.org. A lot of material on there about the biblical foundations of American law and civil government, references to America, a Christian nation, that can help you find that case in the law books, and certainly a lot of history about prayer. Don't hesitate to contact us. There's a lot of information that's not on there. We'd be glad to supply that information or supply it through Radio Liberty.
Well, could you tell the story about General Patton and his very, very famous prayer? Because I think this epitomized what happened during the Second World War, the faith of our military leaders. And, of course, if we had leadership like that today, we wouldn't be in the mess that we are as a nation.
Well,
tell us about that story.
In the December of 1944, the German Wehrmacht had been losing a great deal of ground. Of course, the landing had occurred in D-Day and 6, and they'd moved across France, and they were there was a counterattack. It became known as the Battle of the Bulge, and the Bulge occurred, and the German army had surrounded a little town, Crossroads, which was the key terrain, the key spot, and the 101st Airborne Division was holding on to Bastogne. And Patton was in position and was attacking towards to relieve Bastogne, and the weather turned just absolutely abysmal. Snow, freezing rain, it was bitterly cold, and the weather was terrible, and the meteorologists were saying that it was going to be the same way for 7 to 10 days. It was going to be no let up. That meant there were no air cover, no air sorties, and the Third Army was blocked by the weather. Well, Patton was not to be deterred. Patton, who also, by the way, did a year at the Virginia Military Institute before he moved on and up to West Point where he graduated, but Pratt prayed on his knees, was a man who feared God, and he asked his chaplain to write a prayer that would restrain the immoderate weather and give them good weather for fighting, and it was fairly accurately portrayed in the movie, but the history is much better, and I've read it, the actual account of what occurred by the chaplain who was asked to read the prayer. So the chaplain wrote the prayer, brought it to Patton. Patton got on his knees and prayed the prayer, and then had the prayer distributed to his leaders throughout the whole Third Army, asked them to lead their soldiers in prayer, and then distributed by card so that the soldiers themselves could pray that same prayer. And the upshot of it was that the whole Third Army was praying with Patton. And the next day, the weather, contrary and confounded the meteorologist and all the weather forecasters. The weather was perfect. It was clear. The air sorties were cranked up. The Third Army slashed through and was able to relieve the 101st Airborne Division and break the back of the great counterattack that became the Battle of the Bulge. And it's such a big deal that when they teach military meteorologists, they tell them the story, but they always warn them. They say, well, it's not always going to work like that. You know, they sort of poo-poo it, but that was a clear example of God honoring a faithful man who prayed in the Joshua formulation, prayer prepares the way, action possesses the land.
I had the opportunity one time of spending a couple of weekends with General Albert Wedemeyer, four-star Army general. And he was actually in Sicily just before the invasion. He told me that American naval ships had been, of course, pounding the shore at Sicily, preparing for the invasion. And since he had really been planning, he'd never actually seen a battle, he wanted to go on with the first wave. And so he said that the ship was blacked out. Now, suddenly they've stopped the shelling, the ship is blacked out. And so he's got his backpack on, his weapon, and he goes up the alleyway, and he goes past General Patton's cabin, and there's Patton inside. The ship is blacked out, so he's got a little flashlight, and he's reading the Bible. And he said, George, I just want to say goodbye to you. And Patton came out to the end of the alleyway and said, well, Al, you know, you may be killed, but I want you to know I love you. And he put his arms around him and hugged him. And, fortunately, General Wedemeyer wasn't killed. But here was Patton reading the Bible just before, of course, the great invasion was to take place there that would begin, led, of course, to the taking, ultimately, of Sicily and then of Italy and then the breaking the back of the German military. So it was a great, great story, and I've always really appreciated that. Well, we'll be back in just a moment with our special guest, Colonel Ron Ray, to wrap up this evening's program. Well, Colonel, we've got about 3 minutes before we have to let you go. What are parting thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing that we have a doctrine called military necessity, and the lawyers don't know it, and the pastors don't know it, but basically the judiciary defers to what the military leadership of this country says is necessary to select, train, equip, and defend this nation. And what we just need to do is come back to our first principles. People need to be informed. They need to inform the leaders, because the leadership is not informed. They've been indoctrinated in the schools they've gone to, and they don't understand that judges are not given the task of running the army or the military. The military constitutes a very specialized community. And according to former communist David Horowitz, the armed forces are the last American institution that still has direct contact and is still founded upon those biblical principles intact. All the other institutions in our society have been undermined and moved off those biblical principles, and he said it was their dedication to use women in combat and homosexuals in the military to finish the job on the armed forces. Well, that's obviously going on, but they're also attacking prayer, and they shouldn't get away with it in time of war. We can stop them, but the people need to speak up, stand up, and pray and act.
And I would like to suggest there really is a conscious organized, orchestrated effort to destroy America. It involves the communists. It involves other powerful spiritual forces that have worked undermining the very fabric of our nation. And the problem is that the average person doesn't even realize that the war for the survival of America is not being waged overseas. It's being waged right here in the United States. Well, our guest this evening has been Colonel Ron Ray, who's a retired Marine Corps colonel, and certainly he at one time was the Assistant Secretary of Defense under the Reagan administration. And that's First Principles Press, www.firstprinciplespress.com. Go there, get that information. It will really help you. And, of course, get a copy of the decision of the Church of the Holy Trinity versus the United States in 1892, where the Supreme Court gave what was it, close to over 80 reasons why this was a Christian nation?
66 precedents were cited, but they said there was nothing contrary to it. It could have cited many, many more.
All right, fine. Well, thank you so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure.
Dan, it's always a pleasure to be with you. Enjoy it very much.
Good
best
night.
Wishes. Look forward to another time.
Good night. God bless you. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope you enjoyed the program. I hope that you'll get the information from Colonel Ray. First Principles Press and firstprinciples.org. That's firstprinciples.org. Get those prayers from the great military leaders of the past and understand that America was founded as a Christian nation. Christianity is under attack. There is indeed, as it says in Jeremiah 11:9 and Ezekiel 22:25 in the second Psalm, conspiracy. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and I hope you enjoyed our program this evening with Colonel Ron Ray as we explore what's happening, the attack on the very fabric and structure of our American system. So then, of course, we do hope that many of you out there will decide that you'd like to perhaps help Radio Liberty as we bring you these programs, trying to focus your attention on the true nature of the battle, which is a spiritual battle, which is being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. Now, if you'd like to really understand who it is who rules the world, why, we'd be glad to send you a copy of our newsletter, The Occult Hierarchy, Part 2. And here we don't quote what I say, we quote what the people within the occult hierarchy say. Yes, there really is such an organization. You can go up on Google and Google in occult hierarchy and read down the page, pull down all the articles. You'll find my newsletters there, but you'll find the articles written by people who are part of the occult hierarchy. And they talk about the plan, and they put a capital P on the plan, because the plan really is to establish a world government and a new world religion with the worship of a new God. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We do hope that many of you will go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Certainly you can listen to our programs there on the Internet, 5 hours live every day on the American Freedom Network, the Genesis Network, and then 3 hours on the Radio Liberty Network. You can actually pull down our newsletters and read those newsletters and copy the newsletters and study the newsletters and try to find out if what we're saying is true. If what we're saying isn't true, you have nothing to worry about. But if what we say is true, then your family, your freedom, your future are under attack. And we would like to suggest that there is an effort to undermine the fabric of our society. We don't live in the same society that I grew up in today. There's been an organized effort to undermine and destroy the moral fabric of America. We're living in a pagan America, simply with a facade of Christianity still there. And remember those words of Thomas Jefferson, who said, God, who gave us life, gave us liberty. But can the liberty of a nation be secure when the conviction has been forgotten that liberty is the gift of God? I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, and his justice cannot sleep forever. And I think we should remember those words of Thomas Jefferson. You will never hear them mentioned in schools today, but you can go to Washington, D.C., and you go to the Jefferson Memorial, and you'll see this great statue of Thomas Jefferson there in the memorial, and directly behind it, chiseled into the marble, the ACLU, the Anti-Christian Lawyers Union, hasn't been able to get it out of there yet, but they will continue trying until they can destroy the very Christian foundation of this nation. But there are those words, and I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, and his justice cannot sleep forever. So please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and for our ministers, but please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, our website, RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you. Dr. Stan back here once again, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you that views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But please don't call unless we specifically ask for calls, because right now we have with us on the line Derek Skousen, and he usually has so much to say we don't have time for callers. Derek, thank you so very much for being with us.
Hello, Dr. Stan. Glad to be here.
And of course, Derek is with the World Affairs Brief. He and his brother and their staff of researchers have a most wonderful website that I go to every single day, and that certainly gives you a summary of all the best articles from across the nation, from multiple websites, from the Asia Times and the India Times and the various Times I've never even heard of, and Reuters and BBC, and because you're not going to get the truth from the American media. You might as well face it. The American media is controlled by five mega corporations, Bertelsmann, Disney, Viacom, Fox, and Time Warner, AOL Time Warner. And they pretty much are all going to tell you pretty much the same thing. Oh, they'll fight back and forth like Amos and Andy, but the truth of the matter is, if you want to find out what's really going on in America, you're going to read what they're writing in Asia. You're going to read what they're fighting in India, what they're writing in Pakistan. And well, but that was the background. Derek, tell us what we're going to be talking about this evening.
Well, as we're reviewing all of the news that's in the papers these days, of course, the big story that is everywhere and is all the time out on every channel, both the major news as well as the small news, is the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina and how that is affecting the lives of people, especially in the South, but how those effects are rolling out very rapidly to everyone in North America at this time.
Well, certainly we're seeing the price of certain commodities, gold, silver up, oil is up. There's a feeling of uncertainty in the country. I mean, how could they have been so unprepared? I mean, how could it have been they could have created a situation like this? Obviously, you have a city there that is below sea level, and yet, of course, you know, nobody can seem to repair the dikes. The pumps aren't working, and, of course, there's no real facilities for evacuation of the people. And the people, of course, who did not evacuate, certainly a number of them have died or been trapped, or they're still trapped there in the attics of their buildings. They can't get out.
That's right. The situation is obviously very, very bad in New Orleans and some of the other cities around there. Some of the larger cities in Biloxi and in Gulfport, of course, they're all seeing extensive damage. Everywhere in that area has lost pretty much all of the buildings on the beaches, and the small towns near the beaches have been turned into junkyards, but of course the big cities is where some of the most grievous problems are, as we see anarchy starting to rule the streets there.
And you know, when you begin to hear that not only looting but people shooting at the helicopters that are trying to rescue people, it seems like society's falling apart.
Yes, it really does.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment with the ARC, and I guess we're going to start out talking about the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. But what happens when you have a time like this? When you have people with a strong Christian faith or answerable to God, they'll act responsibly. But when you have an organized effort to destroy the faith of the people, so people don't feel they're answerable to God or to anyone else, why, of course, you get not only moral anarchy, why you get social anarchy, and that's where we're heading. Well, Derek, go ahead and pick up the story.
Well, there are a variety of lessons that we're starting to learn from Hurricane Katrina, and I'm sure there will be more lessons for us to pick up as we hear the news and as we learn what happens as we pull away from this major event in the southern parts of the United States. One of the first lessons, of course, has to do with the preparedness activities and the emergency response activities of the government there and the resources that they have to deal with those emergencies. Now, Hurricane Katrina was not a surprise. The forecasts for the hurricane season have been upgraded several times over the summer as we had some major storms even before the hurricane season officially started, it was definitely predicted that a storm like this would be showing up soon, and so all of the areas in the Gulf had plenty of warning about that kind of storm, and some efforts were made to try and get ready for that for storms in the Gulf at a higher level. One of them, of course, was there was an increase in the stockpile of oil reserves during the months previously, and in the South and in other parts of the U.S., the oil stockpiles were raised to the highest level in several years, which is useful. But one thing that wasn't accounted for was the fact that the damage by Hurricane Katrina shut off so much of the electricity in that area and so many of the pumps and damaged so many of the buildings and systems around those oil stockpiles that it's very difficult to now move the oil and gasoline to the areas where it could be useful. Also, the hurricane damaged a large number of the refineries who would be able to use that oil and turn it into, of course, gasoline, and those refineries who aren't damaged are certainly shut down because of the fact that just simply so many workers uh, can't can get there. So we are seeing that in growing gasoline prices. The $3 a gallon threshold is being crossed all over the United States more and more. And some of that is based on speculation, and some of that is based on you know, real damage and difficulty in terms of moving supplies around the United States at this point.
Well, do you think some of it is just an example of price gouging, that people are desperate for gasoline and they'll pay any price?
Well, there is undoubtedly some severe price gouging.
Hold that thought right there for just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Derek Skousen from World Affairs Brief. And Derek was talking about the fact that oil is in short supply down there. Yes, we have our oil stockpiles or storage, but because of the lack of electricity in many of the areas, why they can't get the pumps working to get the oil out of there. The refineries are shut down. Some of them have been badly damaged. Others, the workers can't get there, and there's no electricity to get the refineries working. So they're developing shortages of gas, gasoline and diesel and the other things that are so necessary for, you know, our highly specialized society, our industrialized society, our mechanized society. It's getting extremely difficult for this to function and function effectively. Would that be a fair statement, Derek?
Well, yes, it is certainly difficult at this point. But I think overall, it's not so much the industrialization of society, but it's the overdependence on systems that are put in place and basically guaranteed by the government to stay in operation, and those guarantees are somewhat slowing people down from putting together the levels of preparedness that should be entirely predictable, given the amount of warnings that we had about the hurricane system season this year.
All right, fine.
Now, of course, with all of those warnings that came out this year, we have to ask the question, what happened to the preparedness levels of the government systems? That's everyone from the Army Corps of Engineers, who's supposed to keep the dikes and flooding out of the dikes up and the flooding out of New Orleans, to the emergency response teams, you know, throughout there, the medical support groups, etc. And the word that has been coming out in the latest stories, as they've been interviewing the people responsible for the failures in that area, and those failures are being shown as being absolutely catastrophic. In fact, the biggest catastrophes of this of the results of Hurricane Katrina are not so much from the damage of Hurricane Katrina itself, but from the lack of preparedness, the lack of ability to maintain the dikes during this year when the high hurricane season was predicted, the lack of having the right stockpiles on hand, and finally, the lack of being able to enforce law and order are going to create the greatest tragedies of this storm. It is not the lack it is not the storm itself that is causing the greatest tragedies, but it is the lack of proper response.
Well, now, what about the military? I understand that a lot of the National Guard units, instead of being kept in the United States to defend the states and defend our homeland, as is their obligation, they're off over there in Iraq fighting in the war there.
That is exactly right. That's what happened to all the emergency response activities. Both the Army Corps of Engineers and the National Guard were decimated by the war in Iraq this year. The budgets were slashed for Homeland Security and war on terror purposes, and all of the resources that emergency services were crying out for, saying, look, the hurricane season is going to be terrible this year, we need to start preparing, were ignored, and those budgets were taken away, and it was all put into the quagmire over in the Middle East.
Of course, we've actually seen a lot of stories about the Office of Homeland Security had all this money and was giving it to all sorts of various communities, and, you know, some police force out in the middle of Indiana or Iowa, getting an armored car, getting, you know, a $300,000 or $400,000 bomb disposal unit that they never would possibly use because they never had a bomb there. They were simply giving this money away, vast amounts of money, and it was simply squandered on material that was of no earthly use to the communities, But if they didn't spend it, why, of course, they'd have to give it back again. And so it was almost like the government was trying to, you know, give away all this money to give the impression they were doing something. But for the really important things to protect America, this wasn't done.
That's right. And all of this, the protection is lost in there. The preparedness things are lost. All of the things that we know how to do and the things that we know how to solve, that we know how to prepare for, all of those, all of the people and the smarts and the solutions were in place by well-meaning Americans in the South, but the budgets were canceled and the means were not made available, and so those preparations went unheeded, and now we're seeing the kinds of news stories and catastrophes and states of unrest that are simply unimaginable for the United States. They're more akin to the kind of news stories we see being written about Middle Africa in terms of the death toll and the states of unrest and the lawlessness and disorder as doctors are being shot out, as medical supplies are being stolen, as violence and looting goes on unchecked while the rest of the whole area is under a tremendous hardship.
Well, we've heard that actually they had to pull a lot of the police out away from trying to stop the looting so that they could start trying to get the people off the roofs of the houses because they didn't have the military forces there because they're all fighting in Georgia's war over there in Iraq.
That's right. Especially during one of the most critical times in any kind of disaster is the first few hours. It's those first few hours that the psychological toll is taken, and that causes that major shift towards unrest. And the National Guard in Louisiana had about 9,000 guardsmen available to them in total, of which 3,000 had been sent away. Over a third had been sent to Iraq, and were in Iraq and are in Iraq at this time. One third of them were available to be deployed, and the other third, of course, were being stuck in their own difficulties and transitions and couldn't be called up in a timely manner.
In other words, they were areas there having to look after their own families.
Exactly. So because of the war of Iraq, half of the guardsmen that might have been available were unavailable at that time. And so instead of 6,000 troops being available, only 3,000 were available, and it takes a fair amount of time for the other states around to respond to that activity. And we will see over the next week or so that there will be probably about 30,000 troops going into that area of the country. But of course, it is very late now, and the amount of troops that is needed and required is so much higher now that the situation of social unrest has grown to such a dramatic scale.
And you know, the thing that's really so disturbing, the National Guard, its purpose is not to fight foreign wars that really a very, very questionable justification. I mean, this was a war of aggression against Iraq. Why are we pulling the National Guard out that's here to defend America, and then when we need them to defend America and to maintain law and order, they're not here? I mean, how is the president going to justify that?
That's right. There is an obvious loss of security. I mean, the Hurricane Katrina is equivalent to a major attack on American soil in terms of the damage, the loss of life, the loss of jobs, the loss of dollars, the loss of social unrest, of disorder. There are bullets flying in the street. This is an attack on America, and yet all of the troops and all of the resources and all of the money and all of the solutions are being blocked and have been blocked and are all being diverted to a foreign policy agenda elsewhere in the world.
All right, fine. Well, it's really such a terrible tragedy, and the suffering of the people down there, and apparently they're having difficulty getting food and water, and of course they're evacuating the hospitals, and I don't know where the patients from the hospitals are going to be going.
Yeah, that's right. And I don't know where they're going to be. I hear is that they can't go anywhere. As soon as they try and evacuate any people, they get shot at. I just heard a story about how some ambulances had to turn around and go back into the inner city because they came under sniper fire. So and you know, this is incredible from those of us who are sitting here talking this evening in the same country. And this is these are places that that you know we may have visited very recently. This is inside the United States here. This is not Middle Africa. This is not the Middle East when we're talking about sniper fire shooting ambulances. This is here in the United States.
Well, I hope they're not going to use this as an excuse to take the weapons away from people. Maybe we need more people with weapons so they can, because snipers are quite willing to fire at people who aren't armed. But if people are armed, they've got to shoot back at them. A lot of these snipers are real cowards.
Well, that's an important aspect to understand and to learn in general from this, from Hurricane Katrina. We'll have to see how the gun control movement picks up on this as it builds and as it grows. That'll be something to watch out for. But in general, one of the things that we are already seeing is that the government's attempts to micromanage the welfare of this area have been disastrous. And in fact, the only successes that have been out there have been by people taking matters into their own hands, using the resources that they have available, and spreading the goodwill and spreading goodness around them as best they can, defending themselves to the best of their abilities, and in general taking matters into their own hands. Those who depended on the government have in general been put into some very, very difficult situations, and the situation in the Superdome is of course the most classic example of that.
Well, of course, I've heard that the Salvation Army is down there and really doing a pretty good job, but you know they've always been the people who've been on the front lines. The Red Cross is telling everybody to donate blood. Why do they want the blood? Why? So they can sell it. I mean, there's not a crying need for transfusions down there. And there's a growing need for food and for, you know, for clothing and things of that sort for the people who don't have any. But, you know, when they say there's an emergency, send us money and donate blood, why, they sell the blood. That's what it's really all about, to raise money. And I think they're really falling under a false flag there. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Derek Skousen. And we're going to be talking, well, whatever the latest issues are in the World Affairs Brief. Well, Derek, go ahead. What do you want? Is there anything else you want to talk about on Katrina, or some other subjects you'd like to cover?
Well, so as we're talking about Hurricane Katrina, we've already mentioned to a certain extent the rise in oil prices, and oil is going to become an increasing issue as we move out from underneath Hurricane Katrina. It seems like it will be unlikely that gasoline prices will drop very quickly, even after the South opens up its transportation, after they get their industry back up, even after those oil refineries open back up. It seems unlikely that the gasoline prices will rise very soon. There's definitely been pressure by the energy industries to basically raise the bar for Americans and their gas prices at this point. I think it is advisable for people to reconsider their usage of gasoline because, in fact, this is probably not so much a spike up in the cost of transportation, the cost of gasoline, the cost of energy in general, but probably more a step up, and that we will see that be more permanent. Some of the reasons behind that is because it is reflecting on on our dependence towards foreign oil, especially now that the Gulf has lost such a large amount of sustained such a large amount of damage there, with over 20 oil platforms losing their moorings and an unknown number of others having significant damage. The ports there being significantly damaged. It's going to take several months at least to even get things back to normal, where that 20% of our oil supply from the Gulf will start to flow again at the paces that we expect. So we're talking months there. And over that time period of months, there's a saying among business people that short catastrophes, a lot, you know, people will not change their pricing habits and their buying habits and other things. But when a price change and price situation lasts longer than 3 or 4 months, then in fact that becomes built into to people's pricing and buying habits, and from an economic standpoint, it becomes less of a spike and more of a sea change in the usage. And so we're probably going to see that apply to the cost of energy here.
Well, I would like to suggest that there's been, for a long time, there's been a conscious, organized effort to get the American people out of their cars. It's part of a grand plan, and you can read it in the Global Biodiversity Assessment. It's a report that came out of the Second Earth Summit in 1992. And we have summaries of that if anybody wants to get that from Radio Liberty. That's a Global Biodiversity Assessment. And, of course, it basically says we want to get people out of their cars, we want to get them onto bicycles, but how would they ever be able to do that? Americans don't want to give up their cars. It's been very obvious for a long period of time that they were going to raise the price of oil and gasoline under one guise or another until they finally could get to the point where people would be willing to change their driving habits. There are people out there who will use any sort of an emergency or any sort of a situation and exploit it to pursue this goal. There is a master plan. It's called Agenda 21, and one of the major thrusts of that entire movement is to get people out of their cars and onto bicycles and to lower our living standards. We'll be right back with Derek Skousen. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Derek was simply saying that he feels that the price of gasoline is going to remain up. You know, it's not necessarily going to be falling. I was simply commenting that I believe there's been a conscious, organized effort for a long period of time to raise the price of oil to get people out of their cars, because there is a plan. There are people who look at the world differently and would lower the living standards here in the United States so that they can raise the living standards in other countries. And that's outlined in the Earth Charter. If you haven't read it, it's up available on the Internet. It's called the Earth Charter, and we suggest you get it, you read it, especially point 10, which talks about redistribution of wealth within nations, which is socialism, and between nations, which is internationalism. This, I believe, they will utilize the tragedy of what's happened now to raise the prices of gasoline. But if prices ever do become, pardon me, if quantities and gasoline ever becomes more available, they're not going to let that price really come down. So pick up the story there, Derek.
So as these gas prices go up, we're going to see some major changes in a variety of economic sectors, especially the transportation sector. And, of course, anybody who drives their car or commutes a fair amount of distance is part of the transportation sector, and they will see that affecting their own household bottom line. And that will move up as we start to consider, for example, all of the independent truckers out there. As their costs go up, it's going to put a fair number of them out of business very quickly. And that just continues to move up the food chain all the way until we get to, say, for example, the airline industries, some of the major ones like Delta, Northwest, and others who are on the very, very edge of bankruptcy right now are probably going to be pushed into that any day now. Because of the jump in gas prices overall. Now, with this jump in gas prices, it creates and all of these bankruptcies and the pressure on the American people specifically, it creates a certain amount of crisis. And as we've talked on this radio show before, crisis is always a tool that is used by those in power and politicians at the moment. And we are seeing some reactions to this crisis and movements in that direction. President Bush has given a few speeches over the last day or so about Hurricane Katrina, etc. A lot of people are a little bit disgruntled about those speeches because they've been a little bit late and slow in coming, and the delivery of those speeches has not been as good as it might have been expected, even from President Bush. And finally, within those speeches is a fair amount of rhetoric about a slight change in the reason for going to war. In other words, the reason for going to war in Iraq President Bush is now saying it's about oil, which is of course a change, since it used to be, of course, about weapons of mass destruction and then about the war on terror, and now it's becoming to be about oil as well.
Wait a minute, now, how do you justify going to war for oil? If he is saying we went to war for oil, then he lied about the weapons of mass destruction, and he lied about wanting to get rid of the wicked Saddam Hussein. And if it's about oil, he's doing a pretty poor job, because the price of oil was going up long before Katrina. Are we going to tell the American people that we attacked Iraq for oil?
Well,
is that what he's suggesting?
But he is suggesting that, I'm not sure if he's yet suggesting that the original attack was about oil, but he is certainly suggesting that our long-term goals in Iraq should be about oil.
Well, of course, what long-term? I thought we were going to go in there and free the people and bring our troops home.
Exactly. But now that there's an increasing oil crisis in the United States, and the longer that oil crisis lasts, the more that this crisis will create a justification by the Bush administration to maintain their presence over the long term in Iraq, so that, quote-unquote, this matter of national security does not fall into hands that may be sympathetic to terrorists, as Bush has been stating over the last day or so.
And I think it's so vitally important that the American people understand that our reason for going to war in Iraq was never what we were told. And those of you who haven't, of course, read my newsletter, specifically the ones that Paul O'Neill's story, which is in Foreknowledge 911, The Conclusion. Paul O'Neill was the Secretary of Treasury. He wrote a book called The Price of Loyalty. You need to either get my newsletter or get his book. And you'll find there that Paul O'Neill was attending meetings of the National Security Council in February and March of the year 2001. He had just become Secretary of the Treasury. George Bush had just become President. And what are they talking about at the National Security Council? How we're going to justify a preemptive attack on Iraq. And he's sitting there saying, why are we talking about Iraq? What are we talking about a preemptive attack on Iraq for? This is many, many months before 9-1-1. And 9-1-1 was a very convenient excuse to justify what they always intended to do. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course for our listeners, I was just commenting on the this what had really happened, why we went to war, and those of you who have not yet seen, we have a little pamphlets we put together, my newsletters, and the conclusion, there are three of them on Foreknowledge 911. The conclusion of the second article there is Paul O'Neill's story. You need to see what the Secretary of Treasury wrote about the plans to go to a war in Iraq for their oil in January and February of the year 2001, long before 911. 911 was the justification for what they always intended to do. So this puts an entirely different complexion on what's going on over there. And our boys are dying, and the Iraqis are dying, and we're antagonizing the world, and we're bankrupting America. And, of course, now we have a crisis here, and we don't have the National Guard troops we need to defend America, because George Bush wanted to take us to war. That's what's unconscionable. Go ahead.
So they have taken us to war, of course, there. And in the meantime, we have been left exposed to this warlike situation in the southern United States, here on our own backyard, and it is of course unconscionable and disconcerting. But I think it's useful to also not take our eye off the Middle East, despite the tragedies in the southern United States. The Middle East, there's a great number of news stories going on there. Things are happening very rapidly. In fact, on the same days that 1,000 people were being drowned or crushed in collapsing buildings and in floods in New Orleans, nearly 1,000 people were drowned and crushed in a mass panic on the bridge across the Tigris River in Iraq. The biggest disaster in Iraq and the largest death toll since the Americans bombed Iraq in the early days of the war. This is This is a very big event in Iraq. It's definitely changing the face of Iraq. As we speak, it's changing the kinds of feelings that are going out there, and it is fomenting a crisis that, of course, has been boiling for a long time.
Well, I think maybe for our listeners who don't know what happened, there were a number of Shia Muslims who were living in Baghdad. Of course, this is primarily a Sunni area, but these were Shia Muslims, and they were marching across a bridge to go to a mosque there to worship, and there was Americans at the far side who set up a checkpoint, and of course they were checking everybody going through so people couldn't get off the bridge. And somebody yells, "There's a terrorist on the bridge. There's going to be an explosion." And just panic, and what was it, about 1,000 people were trampled and suffocated and died? We'll be right back here. About how many people died in that tragedy over in Iraq when the people on the bridge were trampled and suffocated and thrown into the water because somebody had shouted, "Why, there's a terrorist here, there's a terrorist with a bomb." And, of course, the Americans on the far side of the bridge had set up a checkpoint so the people couldn't get off the bridge. What, about 1,000 people died?
Yes. The original death tolls were estimated about 600, but that's been quickly growing over the last day or so as they're finding more and more people. And, of course, the way that that Iraqis have to take care of themselves under these situations where there simply isn't any infrastructure out there means that a lot of people were taken into homes and sick are being taken care of on a much more private basis, and so they're still discovering the dead, and the dead are still turning up.
Well,
in the meantime, of course, it's simply inflaming the ethnic difficulties there between the Shias and the Sunnis, because of course what caused all of this was, as you mentioned, a panic among the Shias that the Sunnis were attacking again. They had just previously that day fired rockets and mortars at the pilgrimage as it was moving across, killing 6 or 7 people and wounding many others. And so, of course, the tensions there were very, very high.
Well, I'm just afraid we're moving into a civil war over there, and that never would have occurred if we hadn't gone in.
That's right. It's moving very, very rapidly towards a civil war. It has been growing in that way because of some of the American policies in terms of law enforcement that have changed over the last few months. As they have brought in, as they've segregated the law enforcement agencies into ethnic groups. So basically, they have the Shias policing the Sunnis, and the Sunnis policing the Kurds, and the Kurds policing the Shias, etc. So you have the different ethnic groups going around acting like thugs and police thugs. Policing the others, and of course that is just inflaming the natural hatred among those groups.
Derek, why would you do something like that unintentionally? I mean, we could have had this situation in hand within a few months after the invasion. Certainly, Lieutenant General Jay Garner, who had, the American officer who had taken Baghdad, wanted to maintain the Iraqi army, wanted to maintain their police force and the infrastructure of their civil servants, and establish a stable society. And Paul Bremer, who's one of the elitists, who is part of the problem, comes in, dissolve the Iraqi army, dissolves, at least fires a lot of the Iraqi police officers, fires a lot of the civil servants, creates total chaos, there's looting, and we don't do anything about it. And now, of course, they're going to have the Sunnis policing the Kurds, and the Kurds policing the Shias. This is a recipe for disaster. Why would you do something like that unintentionally unless you wanted chaos to justify keeping American forces there indefinitely?
That's right. It's either a recipe for an immediate and inflaming civil war, or at the very least, it's a recipe for very long-term cultural unrest and an intractable situation for months and years to come. That's kind of course, the reality is going to be somewhere in between there. But either way, the conflict and the situation there in Iraq is going to last for the long term, and that we should not be expecting American troops to come home anytime soon, but in fact that more and more troops and more resources will be moving over there as time goes on.
And of course, the thing is that our leaders will not tell you this, but they want chaos. Without chaos, they can justify continuing our forces there. They're planning permanently stationing our forces there. How do I know? I've read the plan. You can go to their website. It's newamericansentry.org. That's newamericansentry.org. Pull down the booklet there. It's about 72 pages. It's called Rebuilding America's Defenses. This is the project for the new American century. Rumsfeld, Cheney, Bolton, Wolfowitz, Liddy, Elliot Abrams, all the people who control the government there, Paul Wolfowitz. They're all part of this original 25-man group. They set out to take over our government in 1997. They control it today. They've actually published their plan, Rebuilding America's Defenses, at www.newamericansentry.org. Get it down, read it, and find out they're talking about permanently stationing our troops in the Middle East. How can they justify that? Well, the only way I can see it is just to maintain as much chaos as you can, and then we'll say, geez, oh, folks, we just can't come home. Why, if we did, why there'd be more chaos? And yet we're doing everything we can to foment that chaos.
That's right, and that chaos is building. It's not going down, of course, with that building of chaos, more and more American resources are going to be sent over to that area, and we will be continually building up our presence here, and that is important to contrast with the latest stories that we're hearing about Hurricane Katrina, and as we mentioned, is that those resources are being taken away from the United States, taken away from places like New Orleans, where those resources could have saved people's lives, could have maintained a civil order, and could have turned a very difficult situation. A Category 4 hurricane is nothing to ignore, no matter how many resources you have, but we certainly could have made that situation in a much better one if we had been more focused on the domestic issues as we knew were coming.
Righto. Okay, now, fine. Well, then things are really going sort of from bad to worse over in Iraq?
Well, they are. The situation in Iraq is kind of going from bad to more bad, and it is continuing on that course. But it's getting worse. Yes, in the way that it's going beyond just the civil unrest things. Is going beyond just the U.S. Mistakes. Or the problems that the U.S. has been doing to foment it, but it's starting to take on a life of its own, as these kind of death tolls are no longer the result of clashes between insurgents and IDF forces fighting the international forces fighting the insurgents, but it's now coming down to ethnic clashes between Sunnis and Shias, etc. In the meantime, of course, there is a major election and a referendum coming up in Iraq, as the new constitution, as problematic as it is coming under the vote. That vote will be very dependent on the Sunnis and how they deal with the issues. Of course, with this latest catastrophe in Baghdad, the pressure on the Sunnis is going to be such that that vote is very uncertain at this stage, and that will simply throw the timeline that President Bush might have had about his strategies in Iraq kind of in disarray for a long term, and we will have to put off all of the any rhetoric that they might have been preparing about a pullout, which, of course, we know isn't coming because of all the number of dollars that are flowing to Iraq.
And, of course, if anybody would like to know what's really planned, there's a latest issue of Foreign Affairs magazine, which is published by the Council on Foreign Relations, which controls both political parties and is America's invisible government. The September-October issue has an article in there on how to win in Iraq. And the closing paragraph says it's going to take us another 10 years and countless billions of dollars more to win. Another 10 years? Are the American people willing to continue over there another 10 years? And everything we do seems to lead to higher gas prices? Well, go ahead, pick up the story there, Derek.
That's right. The amount of resources flowing to Iraq is massive. Recently, the U.S. Treasury put out its report about the cost, and it said that the adjusted costs for the war in Iraq have recently exceeded the costs to the United States of the war in Vietnam. It says that the total bill for the war in Iraq has come to $204 billion, and that is an average of $727 per U.S. citizen, and that is not counting the additional $45 billion which is currently pending before Congress. And so that is, it also doesn't include another $25 billion request that the Pentagon is preparing to submit to Congress next year. So that's a very big cost. It's probably, I haven't seen the latest figures on the damage by Hurricane Katrina, but it seems that this war in Iraq is costing us on the order of at least that much of anything that that has been hit in the U.S. in the last few years.
Okay, well, I think that it's really a tragic situation, and of course everybody is choosing up sides. You're going to be on Cindy Sheehan's side, you're going to be on the president's side, and I think we really shouldn't try to choose up sides. We ought to say, why did we really going in? Were we lied to about going in? What is the real objective? And, of course, the real objective is to keep our troops there indefinitely. That's what it's about. When you understand that, it all makes sense. If you're looking for logic, they're going to give you all sorts of misinformation and disinformation. I suggest my newsletter, I believe that's the July newsletter, of the origin of wars. And I think it's as clear and concise as anything I know to explain why we really went into Iraq. Not what you're told by the controlled media, but why we really went in. Go ahead.
Yes, I agree. We should not be choosing the sides that the mass media in the U.S. is setting up for us. You know that these sides are you know kind of based on political grounds. They are ineffectual overall. They are not putting together the real picture that we're seeing that we can put together if we analyze the news that comes out all throughout the world. We put together the predictions, we see how the resources are flowing, how they're flowing away from the Army Corps of Engineers in New Orleans and towards the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. As we put all of these stories one after another together, we can start to get our own picture and put together a side that is based on a much bigger and broader picture and avoid being cubbyholed into a position that seems to be dominated by an agenda-run government and media.
And I think it's really so interesting. Over in Iraq, one of the things that Saddam Hussein did was to drain the swamps in the southern part of Iraq where the swamp people lived. And there were groups of people there who opposed Saddam, and they lived in this swamp, and they, you know, and they'd been living there for generations. And Saddam drained the swamps. Well, you'll be glad to know that the Americans have reinstituted the swamps there so that it's just like it was before, and the people now are back living in the swamps. Apparently, they like living there. But we're spending our money and sending our engineers over there to reinstitute the swamps and the swampy part of southern Iraq. But, of course, we're totally ignoring New Orleans, which they knew was a disaster waiting to happen, because the entire city is much lower than both the Mississippi and the adjacent large lake. And instead of spending our money on American infrastructure while we're building up Iraq's infrastructure, and we're recreating the wetlands of southern Iraq.
That's right. Yeah, so it's this, you know, one of the things that we've learned over the last many years is the way to put together a more clear picture of what's really going on in the world is to follow the money and to follow where the resources are flowing. And so these examples are excellent examples to continue to put together as we try and put together a position that is based on truth, that is based on history, and so that history is not manipulated and controlled by those who would control our views. And control truth to a certain extent.
Okay, well, we've got about 4 or 5 more minutes, so what are the next issues?
All right, well, maybe we'll just do a quick roundup then of a couple of issues. We have something that has kind of been lost over the last few days with all of the news from Hurricane Katrina has been the aftermath from the Gaza pullout, and there are two sides, two things going on after the Gaza pullout. One is that they're preparing for elections over there, and of course Sharon has come under a great deal of fire because of the Gaza pullout, and especially the lack of response, of good response from the Palestinians in terms of quid pro quo from this major concession of the Israelis. The Palestinians and of course the terrorists there are just claiming victory over the whole thing, and so the Jews in Israel are very disgruntled with Sharon at this stage, and so there seems to be some kind of campaign to try and make something useful for the Israelis to come out of the Gaza pullout, and we're seeing that in two aspects, and I think this is just beginning. But the first is that Pakistan opened diplomatic relations with Israel today. That's actually a fairly big deal because Pakistan is one of the biggest Muslim and strongest Muslim countries in that area. Pakistan does not recognize Israel as a country, and of course they don't dare still recognize Israel as a country. There was definitely some kind of diplomatic concession as representatives from both Israel and Pakistan met at a hotel in Istanbul, Turkey.
But don't you really think that that's because we are bribing Musharraf? We're financing Musharraf. He's the dictator of Pakistan. I mean, we're so concerned about democracy, and yet we're financing the dictator, and we tell him what to do. And don't you think Musharraf is really doing what we want and making some concessions, and is really going to look good on paper? But do you think it's going to change the hatred of the Muslim for the Jews?
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because to a certain extent, Musharraf had to kind of play both sides of the fence on this particular issue. He claimed encouragement to the activity that was going on there. He also claimed that it had some quote unquote backing by Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah and the Palestinian leader Mohammed Abbas, he also had to reemphasize the fact that they still do not recognize Israel as a country and will not until all Palestinian demands are met, et cetera, et cetera.
And the Palestinian demand that Israel, of course, abandon its country. So there is no way that the Israelis can make the concessions that will please the Palestinians, because they're determined to kill all the Jews and drive them into the sea. So, you know, certainly to have given up Gaza without any concessions at all is the ultimate sign of either stupidity or something far more sinister. It's going to be very interesting. I suppose that Sharon's going to run against Netanyahu. A lot of people rally behind Netanyahu, and yet I think he's controlled it by exactly the same people that controlled Ariel Sharon. We'll be back here in just a moment with Derek and get his thoughts on that. Well, I guess this evening is Derek Skousen from World Affairs Brief. Derek, before we do anything else, please get your address, your telephone number out. How can people get in touch with you?
Sure. The best way to get in touch with the World Affairs Brief and to learn more about what we're doing is to visit us on the web. We do most of our things online at www.worldaffairsbrief.com, and if you'll go there, you'll see kind of the two or three sides that we have. First, and things that we offer to you. First, we offer on the homepage a collection of news stories from all over the world that have to do with the issues that we're talking about today as they appear, and to see them all in one place as they've been pulled out of the mass of newspapers, pulled out from behind the back pages of newspapers and pulled out from websites all over the world. To see them all in one place, I think, is valuable. The second thing is, of course, the World Affairs Brief itself. This is a weekly email newsletter that is sent to all the subscribers, and you can subscribe very easily there from the web. If you'd like to get a free copy of the latest newsletter as a sample, give us a call at the toll-free number 1-877-518-5888. That's 877-518-5888.
All right, fine, and it's an excellent source of information. I recommend it to you. It's www.worldaffairsbrief.com. Go there first thing every morning, worldaffairsbrief.com. Okay, what are your take on what's going to happen there? Is there going to be a runoff between Sharon and Netanyahu, or is it going to be a vote having to do between the conservatives and the liberal? And, of course, I think people have to understand that both the liberal and the conservative are going exactly the same direction there, just as they are here in the United States.
Very much so. In fact, it's important to remember that, to answer your question, there will be a runoff between Sharon and Netanyahu. It's unclear whether it will happen earlier than January, but January is probably the estimated time frame for that. Certainly the rhetoric is already heating up about that. What's important to remember is that Sharon and Netanyahu are pretty much the same face. They're the same coin, just two sides of the same thing. In fact, it's important to understand that the key issue, and of course, this election is the withdrawal from Gaza and whether or not that was too much or whether or not that was justified. And we will see more stories like minor but meaningless concessions, such as the diplomatic effects with Pakistan and the signing of the treaty with Egypt to patrol the border in Gaza. But it's important to remember that Netanyahu voted four times for the
Hold that thought for just a moment. Well, Dr. Stan, I guess this evening, Derek Skousen. Derek is saying that there is going to be a vote over there, probably between Sharon and Netanyahu, and everybody thinks there's a difference between them. It is my contention, I suspect it's Derek's contention, that they're two sides of the same coin. And you were just saying that Netanyahu had actually voted for the pullout?
That's right. Netanyahu voted for the pullout several times throughout the process. And it was only at the very last stages, after the pullout was already set, that Netanyahu turned around, he basically did an about-face, resigned over the Gaza pullout, and set himself up to become in a new political position to run as as the opposing party to Sharon. Whereas, in fact, policy-wise, he had been pretty much towing the Sharon line all along. So they are in fact really the same characters, the same level of principles, the same kind of policies, and above all, they are in the same way wedded to the global agenda that is influencing all of the Middle East.
But I think most people don't understand that this whole sham of democracy, you get two candidates that want exactly the same thing. They argue back and forth. They insult one another. They pretend to be different. But there's not a dime's worth of difference between them. We're out of time, Derek. God bless you. Thanks so much for being with us. And these are exciting times. We'll look forward to having you with us again next week.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Good night. God bless. Okay, that was Derek Skousen from the World Affairs Brief, and we recommend the information there strongly to you, www.worldaffairsbrief.com. Well, this is the time when I have to remind our listening audience that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. We're dependent upon those of you who believe that we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, cultural, educational, economic battlefield. And if you'd like to help us so that we can reach out across America, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. I want to mention, of course, we are expanding. We'll be on starting on September 5th on 16 new stations every afternoon at 3. And if you're in a position to help us, we'd certainly appreciate hearing from you. We're going to be having our annual seminar here in the Santa Cruz area. That's going to be on the 19th of November. It's an all-day seminar, as we have every year, and we do hope that many of you will be able to come down and bring other people, because we'll have a good time. We'll get a lot of information, and I think people always enjoy realizing there are a lot of other people out there not only here in California, but out across America, who are aware of what's going on. And of course, it's great to talk to them and to meet them, and hopefully a good time will be had by all. So that'll be all day on the 19th of November. And if you're coming from outside, then we can tell you which are the best hotels. Again, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. You can go to our website at www.radioliberty.com. You can listen to our programs there on the Internet, 5 hours live every day. And then, of course, if you have some more time, you can listen there on the archive programs as well. Please read our newsletters. Please copy them. Encourage others to listen. And then, of course, pray for America. Pray for revival, pray for our leaders and ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection, and